Hi, everybody. I'm Traven Rice. I am an arts and culture editor and co-founder of The Lowdown. And we are here at PNT Knitwear for the Lowdown Culture Cast, where we talk with culture changers. And I've been talking with people who I think have contributed to culture change in a constructive, positive way in all different types of cultures, Lower East Side and downtown in general. And so today we are going to be speaking with a very dear person in my life. Roshi Pat Enkyo O'Hara is here, and she is the abbot of Village Zendo in downtown Manhattan. It's a Soto Zen contemporary American Buddhist meditation center that she co-founded. She is a Soto Zen priest and integrates traditional meditation and koan practice with social engagement and peacemaking. A founding teacher of the Zen Peacemaker Order, she taught for many years at New York University's Tisch School of the Arts, centering on new media technologies and something called media ecology and social justice. Her focus is on the expression of Zen through caring, service, and creative response. Roshi O'Hara's writing has appeared in Tricycle, Turning Wheel, Shambhala Sun, Buddha Dharma, and other Buddhist journals, as well as her recently released book, Most Intimate, A Zen Approach to Life's Challenges. And she often gives many Dharma talks. So, welcome to the Lowdown Culture Cast. I'm so happy to have you here.
Yes, I watch the Culture Cast, so I'm awed that you asked me to come.
Oh, thank you. Of course. Well, I wanted to hear about how you got into Zen, but also a little bit about your work in media ecology back in the day.
Yeah, actually, they're not so separate in a way, you could say. I mean, I fell in love with the idea of Zen when I was a young woman, reading Shunryu Suzuki's Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And so I went around, like most people do, for 20 years, thinking I knew what Zen was, and I was a very Zen-thinking person, but not practicing Zen. But finally, one day, I managed to take a workshop at a Zen temple and said, oh, this is a whole different thing. This is just sitting. This is being present to what is. So that's not so different from my approach to media. I first became really involved with working with cable TV and senior citizens, and I was kind of managing a project for like 5 years. We had all these technical problems about where to put the microphone, where to put the camera, what kind of questions to ask. And I just loved it. And then I went on to do other kinds of media, audio conferencing and computer conferencing. And they hired me at NYU to teach a course in an interactive program, and I did that for 20 years, and that was so great fun. I loved working with students and having projects, and we had a lot of projects around New York City. It was great, great fun to use it as a technology. And I could say that, you know, at the same time I was exploring how you could use Zen as a technology to wake us up.
And when you say you had all these challenges with where to put the microphone, where to put the camera, you're talking about a time when the cameras were not on a little phone.
No, there were people. There were young people we had running. We had to train the people how to use the cameras.
And they were big.
Yeah, they were big. They were like this. You were moving them around on whatever you call those, roller balls all over. That was great. Those were wonderfully complicated days. And now, like you say, everything is like right here.
Thank you. But you had an idea as far as the interactive part in the early days about how to reach people through cable in a sense of how to help them.
Absolutely. The key was to find a way for people to feel comfortable enough to be intimate with someone whom they're speaking with and interacting with. And how do you do that? And how do you do that at a distance? You know, I think we're still, at this point, figuring that out in the world. How do you make two people have a conversation who are, you know, continents apart and be able to do that? And so we were experimenting with that, and it was fun. It was, you learned a lot about how we as humans make communication, although we were using old-fashioned technologies. Mm-hmm. Whether they're old-fashioned now, they were brand new then.
But it was still with the intention of connecting and seeing what they needed as far as, it was, you said seniors?
Yes, they were different senior citizen centers that we would connect and have them connect with the mayor of the city to talk about, you know, traffic lights and very direct kinds of things. And then we had all kinds of programming for them to interact with one another. It was a great project, funded by the National Science Foundation back in the day.
And a little bit of a different version of a hyperlocal community news website, maybe.
Exactly. Exactly. We are reliving this very thing.
Yeah. And so at that time, then you happened to get interested in Zen.
Yes, and I just fell in love with the actual practice of it. I had always thought that I knew what it was because I'd read about it, and it's a very different experience to practice in it, to actually sit and not get up and walk out the door, but to sit through your issues and the issues of the world and to find a quiet place within yourself. And I just was really delighted with that, and I wanted to share it. I wanted to share it with others. And actually, it was hard. It's hard to do alone. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things that's really hard to do alone.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I would say, okay, I'm going to sit in meditation. And then suddenly I'd find myself walking down the street getting a cup of coffee. And I thought, what happened to me? What if I invite some people over to my house and sit?
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll all be able to sit. Mm-hmm. And that's how our group started. And they started in my apartment. And I was fortunate enough, I was in faculty housing at the time, so it was a large space. And I was just able to get rid of all my furniture in the living room, dining room, and turn it into a little mini zendo, a place. Zendo means a place where you practice. And people came. People just came, and it became a thing. It was great.
And this was at a time when I would say that Zen had not been in America that long, maybe a decade or two.
Right, right.
But fairly new as far as coming over that tradition from Japan here.
That's true.
So a lot of it was new.
It was new, but it was also had this kind of hip quality to it. And you know, I'm teaching in around a block from Washington Square, so I've got a neighborhood of people. I got a lot of artists and musicians who joined the community. And there, in that community, it had been around for about 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a kind of comfort with the idea of practicing Zen, of finding a way to do that. Trungpa Rinpoche, from not a Zen but a Tibetan practitioner, was probably one of the first people to kind of bring that to the artistic community, and it took, and so that's what happened with us too.
Mm-hmm. And that was sort of a little bit later, but this time of the beat poets, you had bringing some ideas over.
The same kind of ideas that whole tradition that was appreciated. Allen Ginsberg was a practiced in Zen, and he was just a few blocks away in the East Village. So
right.
So it was an easy place, you know. If I had sat down in Iowa in a small town, I'm not sure it would have blossomed as it did. And it wasn't intended to be a thing, an organization or anything. It was just, let's practice together. And then it grew like Topsy.
Mm-hmm. And some of the people that you were studying with and practicing with seem to have really become engaged in the community around them and saw ways that they could serve and help people. This was a time when you had, I think you've mentioned that there were friends that were sick with AIDS.
Yes, we started in the early 80s, after a couple of years, AIDS came. And, I can just remember there were people coming down with it. And so it just seemed natural that, oh, well, we have to do something. It's like if if there's a fire in your neighborhood, you go and you get water. And we took care of our own. We had several people in our sangha. But also, I started a project at Gay Men's Health Crisis, and I used to put my meditation cushion on my bike and ride over there and every week and have a meditation session there, and which brought more people to our zendo, of course, mm-hmm. who were affected. And then I got involved on the national level. I was kind of a chair of the Buddhist AIDS Network for years, and that was just an organization that tried to make pontificate, make statements with other religious leaders and so forth. Mm-hmm. So that was something that was happening that you take care of. And what happens when you practice meditation is you realize that you have a responsibility for everything. And so I think people just do what's in front of them, and what was in front of us at that time was HIV/AIDS.
And about that same time, you were one of the founders and leading teachers of Zen Peacemakers?
Yes. Bernie Glassman, who is like kind of very well-known person and Zen teacher, was very dedicated to social action, and he founded a several organizations related to poverty and building housing for people. And then when the AIDS came, he was able to get a large group of people to start a hospice, mm-hmm. And so he did a lot of work in that, and I helped him. I was like his assistant, really. And that was a great time because in Zen we have this very hierarchical study system that's complicated. And, a lot of people think about it as monastic. But my practice with him was, I'd pick him up in the car and we'd be driving around in the car and we would do a koan study and then we'd go pick up something that needed to be done. And it was kind of like social action on a very gut level. And at the same time, kind of always there was an opportunity to see how service or taking care of others is the practice of life, really. And that was the big teaching.
Mm-hmm. Social action on a very gut level. So maybe the reality, not the idea.
Not the idea. No, it actually cleaning up the shit.
Literally, maybe.
Literally, yes. Bernie was great for that. We went on several, he used to lead street retreats where we'd go. And naturally, since I lived downtown, we would go, when I'd go with him, we'd be down here. Yeah. And we'd go to the different homeless shelters and on the Bowery, we'd go on into the places where people are fed and listen to the sermons and the songs and eat the food and hang with the people there, or go down to the park at Tompkins Square Park and sit around and talk to people,
yeah,
and see what it's like and sleep on a bench.
And what was that experience like?
That was fantastic. It changed my life. It really did. I just sitting on the sidewalk, with a can there waiting for somebody to throw in enough money so I could get a coffee, just made me realize how easy it is to just walk around above it all and feel as if you are not part of the suffering that is always here. And since I was maybe cold and want some coffee, and then watching people You know, I used to do it near NYU, and I would see colleagues just walk by and not look down.
You know?
It was so interesting.
Yeah.
It really was. And not just for them, but for me too. How often do I just not see the suffering around? And, you know, I just think that in Zen, we really believe we have a responsibility to do something about that. Mm-hmm. That's our job as humans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think, so there was a term called, there's some people waving out on the street, I don't heard.
Bye.
I mean, I'm not familiar with when the term engaged Buddhism really came about, but that is what was happening, what you were doing.
That's what we're talking about, because, I mean, one could say probably anyone who lives a truly spiritual life becomes engaged in the world. But there are these, but if you're isolated in a monastery or you're isolated in some sort of perfect place, you may not be aware of the suffering that's around. But in the Zen tradition, we have these kind of things that we do, like we go around and beg, like once every couple of months, we go out on the street and beg. And doing that really, really makes you humble.
You know? Right.
And doing that here in New York City makes you very humble because nobody wants to give.
Right.
So there's that quality of just recognizing our interconnection and our responsibility.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it started in the living room, and then you had enough people coming that you found a space where it was a little more formalized?
That's right. And so, yeah, it kind of like Topsy, it just grew. It started out in the living room, and then there were enough people that didn't fit there, and what would it be like to not have all that going on in your apartment. And so we've moved like three times. We were on Varick Street, we were on Broadway, and now we're on West Broadway, which I think is our final perfect place. But we've grown. Because of the pandemic, we now have people all over that practice with us daily, you know, from across the country and around the world, really. Someone from New Zealand, I just got an email from someone from New Zealand, said, I'm going to miss the sitting. she must sit like 3 a.m. or something.
Yeah, so it's like a hybrid format, right?
Right, right.
But that's sort of the way things are going now, is more and more, how can we be together while we're not physically together? You know, how have you found that to be, that process of navigating at all these changes from the media side, but also just community side?
Yeah, it's tough. I think it people don't really, I mean, everyone wants to make it easy and nice, but I think it's tough because we're communicating, like right now, we're communicating electronically, but we're not talking to the people out there. They're listening to us. So to be able to really constantly re-engage so that people know that there's a connection, that's really the challenge. And we're working on it. I mean, Zoom, of course, everybody's talking about this. I mean, this is an issue. How do you do that? I mean, you can't replicate being right next to someone, but you can learn to open your heart so that you can talk to someone at a distance. And I think that's happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm concerned for younger people who've gone through the pandemic and are online all the time.
Right.
And are missing a bit of that feeling that we have from before, where we're able to be together in person.
Yeah. No, you make a very good point. I mean, the physicality of being in, sitting next to someone, and so you're meditating and you're quiet, and you're here, but there is a body there, and that's something that is lost when it's at a distance. So it's great to have people who are at a distance be able to participate, but I would encourage them to, you know, if they can, have someone else come and sit with them so that there's two or three of them
yeah
one line. And yeah. that would help a great deal, that kind of physicality that mm-hmm. you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It's very good.
I know that rigid training early days of for Zen practice or Buddhist practice includes, for many people, going to a monastery, right. which you did, which was in Japan. Mm-hmm. And that's like a really intense form of being together.
Yeah, yes, indeed. Yeah, and we even still, we have a couple of times a year, we have retreats like for a week or 3 weeks where we go and rent a space and maybe we have about 30 or 40 of us that actually live together. And I think it's a good experience to have that periodically. But we are a 21st century urban Zen center and we have to mostly pay attention to the experience of people day to day, how they live their lives, and how they can feel that they are part of something greater, which mm-hmm. is everybody, which being part of everyone. And with that comes our responsibility to take care of people.
Yeah. You know?
Just like, I mean, we fall in love with somebody, we want to take care of them. We have babies, we want to take care of them. And when we live in a city, we want to take care of the people that are also here with us.
Well, coming from sort of the studying a rigid form of Zen in Japan and then being part of that transition as it came here and sort of as it became Americanized, you've really been a part of this for many decades, I would say. Lots of differences that happened when, you know, traditionally, as in everything, it was very male-dominated.
Yeah.
The practice, the monasteries, the teachers.
That's really true. I just have been blessed. And also, I came later to Zen. I mean, although I read about it a lot. But, you know, I was in my late 30s when I began to be sincere about practice. And I've just been blessed in my life that I haven't had to push up against that kind of bias, which I know exists and is terrible. But I personally, no. I mean, mm-hmm. I just have always felt like you just go ahead and do your thing. And if someone, you know, is sexist, you just cut them out of your life. You don't deal with that.
Yeah.
I mean, I really appreciate the women who stood up and did deal with it and spoke up and so forth. But I just didn't have that opportunity because everyone was just fine with me going forward.
And forging your own path.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, I have to say, like at NYU, I worked for a woman
uh-huh.
for many years. And then there were other women on the faculty. And so it didn't happen. And that's a place where it could happen. It does happen often, but it didn't happen in my specific case.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And my teachers, my male teachers in Zen, were for the most part, 2 out of 3, were not sexist. And I won't go into that any further than that.
Yes, it does sound like you were lucky in that sense. But yeah. I think also you just, from what I can tell, you just, decided to forge your path and to be a model. I don't know how much people are conscious of deciding to do that, but just the way that anybody is leading or leading a group or organizing is always going to be a model and will be reflected, you know, out, I would say.
Yeah, I don't think we're conscious of it, though. I mean, my concern was a community, was getting the community together, getting support, and getting help. I mean, that's what support is. Like, will you open the doors when I'm not able to? How about will you have a pot of coffee on or tea? And so that's like the beginning of building a community, just generating the generosity of others and allowing them to see, oh, yeah, I can help out. Mm-hmm. I can serve this. So I think one of the jobs of a leader is to step back a lot to be sure that others step in.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a important for the community building, really.
So going forward with Village Zendo, what would your hopes and dreams for it be into the future?
Yes, well, I'm at retirement age for sure, and so I'm seeing new leaders come up with new ideas and different ways of doing things. And so to see a graceful transition like that is my hope. Mm-hmm. And I would like to see it grow. And we have been, we were deeply affected by the pandemic. As you know, all the empty buildings in New York, you can see we're not the only ones. But what I'd like to see us build up again so that the Zendo is full of people coming to practice. They're just coming in to sit and to activate different issues that arise. We've also always been very politically active, and that's been kind of on the quiet side too, and I'd like to see more of that.
Yeah, okay. I'd like to see that too.
Good.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for asking all these questions. It's great.
It's my pleasure. Okay. It's a pleasure to have you. Good.